This is an oral history interview with Leslie Bale. And the first question that I would like to ask you, Leslie, is could we start off perhaps by discussing a little bit about your family history? How many generations of your family have farmed and lived in Dunedin? And what kind of stories or details of family history were passed down by your parents and grandparents' generation?
Right. Our farm was in Lisnatruska, Timbridget, and around about 100 acres. And my father inherited the first 30 acres of that farm from an Uncle John, who had none of his own family survived. Then he bought a neighbouring farm, which is the farm which had the big thatched rectory that went eventually to the Ulster Folk Museum. Stories passed down by parents and grandparents was just, as I'm telling you now, I don't know much more about prior to that. That was our original farm. And that's as much I can tell you about that.
Excellent. And what would your earliest childhood memories be from growing up?
Well, a lot of farming activity about our place all the time, and there was men that worked for my father in different capacities. And they would have been about at haymaking times and things like that. All our childhood memories going to school, of course, that will be answered later on. And working with the men and sailing on lorries and things like that.
And coming on to that, could you tell us a little bit about whenever you went to school and what some of the teachers and pupils that you can recall and the memories of the curriculum?
Well, the first two teachers I had at the main school was Mr. Giffen, and the junior teacher was Mrs. Wilson, and the man Giffen, he was a gunner in the Air Force, and all those boys of war experience all got privileged jobs, and he trained himself to be a school teacher. He was my first principal. Mrs. Wilson was the one that taught me in my infancy, and moved on to under Mr. Giffen. Then he left when I was about 8 years old, and then there was a man called popular name around that clock country. And I forget his name now. Oh, sorry about this.
No, you're okay, don't worry.
There was a second man coming out. He took me on till I went and done my 11 plus, of which I failed. And that, as far as the Dunedin Primary School is concerned, that's as much experience as I have had.
And what were the popular sports or games at
school? Hockey, kick the ball around a bit of grass outside the school, and that was it.
Nothing too complicated.
No.
Well then, when it came to farming community like Dunedin, how did the school attendance change with the seasons? And for instance, were children called out to help with the potato gathering?
That's right. It was traditional in the month of end of September, October, that you got a week's potato gathering holidays. And all the youngsters of the community pulled together and help all the farmers, a few pounds to help their mothers along.
And could you give us a description of the Bale farm when you were growing up in the 50s and 60s? I mean, how were each of the fields and farmhouses used?
Well, in those days, there wasn't the capacity of farm buildings that there is today. There's just basically a wee small byre and a hay shed to store a lot of hay. The fields were very, very small, maybe an average of 3-4 acres. And the soil type on our farm was varied. The farm that my father inherited from his uncle, the soil type was first class. As we moved across towards the other farm, there was old hilly, steep fields on it, and it wasn't fit to be cultivated. That was only for grazing. But generally, 3/4 of the farm had been good on the land.
Well, Eston Evans wrote a book called Irish Folk Ways, and he talked a little bit about how the typical country farmhouse was laid out. And he talked about the fact that the farmhouse was a simple rectangle and ground plan. And then the developed house had 3 rooms consisting of a kitchen, a bedroom, and then the best room behind the chimney. But could you describe the interior?
That was just a typical explanation of what my home farmhouse that I was brought up in was.
And I mean, what kind of memories do you have of the farmhouse at home?
Well, I remember just an old pipe stove that my mother baked on, and then moved on to the later years of what then was called the modern range. In those days, everyone that worked on the farm stayed in the house, and it was like a banquet every day in our house. There was not many farmers and workers were fed, and they were all fed in the house. And it was a Killian house too. People come and all times of day and night and just sat down, and they had time to spend, and thought you had time to spare to talk to them. You know?
But like now, maybe, you know, we're talking. Moving on a little bit to childhood and different books and things. Rosemary Harris has written a lot about her childhood in County Tyrone, and she argued that children were expected to behave as adults at a very young age. And she said that all farmers wanted children because help was essential to the running of the farm. Children began to help from about the time they were six. And on the smaller farms, children rarely went to play except with their brothers and sisters. At what age did you begin to help out?
You got involved and you had chores to do at early ages, like bringing in the coal and bringing in the turf and maybe help sweep the floor and things like that. And then that grew on to when you were bigger, you maybe had to help cord cattle and things like that. I remember my father used to take ground in Shane's Castle Estate, and the cattle had to be walked to Shane's Castle Estate. There was no lorries or nothing to take them. And there was a neighbouring family, a McFall family, and there was about seven or eight young boys in that, and we kicked football together and done nothing, and we spent a lot of time up at our place. And they helped us to hoard these cattle to Shane's Castle Estate. And you were behind the cattle, and then the cattle were held back, so that all those guys at the back got to the front and were standing on different gate posts and all the way. And then they got to the stage, you run out, they were stopped again, and they went to the front again. And my father, he had a wee Volkswagen car, and he went down Randallstown Street. I had to go down Randallstown Street, don't forget that. And went down Randallstown Street, and the first place he had to go to was called Scott's Grocer Shop in Randallstown. He always had an array of flowers in the pavement for sale. They had them moved off the pavement. And we walked those cattle down Randallstown Street, and we were quite glad to see them come in through the gates of Shane's Castle. And you were going to treat the ice cream on the road home, that was your pay.
There's a lot of gates and places to run.
But then there was no traffic in the roads. And that was down the main, which was the old A6 road. That weren't going back roads or anything like that.
But as you say, that the traffic was
minimal.
So what kind of relationship did you have with your father in the farmyard? And how did
Well, my father was away a lot. He was away business and dealing a lot. I had more relations with men that were working on the farm, and I always say I had good relations with them, and not about the height of that. Mm-hmm. But I had good relations with my father, a different capacity.
Of course. Yeah. And how did those men help to educate you in the ways of the farm?
You just watched. Mm-hmm. You just watched what they did, and you followed suit. Mm-hmm. I had an uncle who wasn't married and lived with us. He milked the cows. And he was up early, never missed the morning, up early every morning, milk the cows, and wheeled the milk out in cans. He would have maybe 8 or 10 milk cans, and they were wheeled onto a makeshift ramp. And Mickey Laverty's milk lorry would come and lift at them every morning.
Well,
and in the early days, there was no refrigeration or anything like that. We just cooled the milk with just ordinary cold water. And then I remember my father buying a refrigerator, mm-hmm. and it chilled the water that was running down the side of the can to cool the milk. And you see the milk, I remember us, it was a treat for the cup of cold milk out of the churn before it went to Mickey Laverty's lorry. That was a real treat.
Especially in weather like this.
Yeah.
Well, Jonathan Bale is an historian of Ulster farming, and he outlines that gender labour divisions place women very much in the domestic role in the farmyard in the 50s and 60s. What kind of responsibilities did your mother have?
Well, my mother was an independent woman, and she kept a lot of hens,
mm-hmm.
even from a very early stage, just simple small hen houses out in the field. And then they moved on in the 60s to the battery cage system.
Mm-hmm.
And she done quite well at that, and she was a great assistance to my father in bringing an income into the family. And she did all that housework and catered for everybody as well. So we contributed. When we came home from school, we all had to go out and help collect these eggs. And then the eggs were being put in cases, and they were putting George McLaren's grocery van. And my mother always got money back.
Yes.
After the groceries was paid out of the egg money, she had money, surplus money. And so
it was almost like bartering then?
It was a sort of a barter trade, yeah. And what else is that?
Well, I was going to ask, how did women contribute to the field work as well?
I know my mother wouldn't have been involved in that, other than sending tea to the field to the workers and things like that. But she would have been out working in the fields. But I remember in the early days, there was two woman lived beside us, a Mrs. Dunley and a Mrs. McElroy.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember them helping to plant potatoes and a wheat field. It was about 2.5 acres of it, and the drills were opened,
mm-hmm.
and the dung was scattered up the drills. And these two women with two basket type crates walked up and they planted the potatoes. And then the tractor come behind and covered them and made the drills. Well, I remember that now. Yeah.
Well, whenever you were a youngster, how did you spend your leisure time on the farm?
Oh, just with the McCall boys and ourselves and other wee boys were about. There was always some plenty of activity at our house. We were lucky that we had the McCall family beside us. They were a big family of, I think there were 7 boys before there was a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all of the one age, and we always were about our house. And we kicked football and done things about the farm together and things like that. But they were great for us. They went to Woolley Next School, we went to the main school, and we spent the evenings together.
and
you can ask, there's one lives down the road here, a Johnny one. He's only home from London. He lived in London for 52 years. If you want to know some of the things about Bales, ask Johnny McFall.
I must do. Well, whenever you were young then, did you get into the cinema? I mean, was it affordable to go to the cinema if you came?
No, I wouldn't have been at the cinema until I would have been 16 or 17 years of age.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's your early memories of going to the cinema?
Well, the first cinema I was ever at was in Randallstown.
Oh, yes, which is now gone,
unfortunately. Now gone. And there was the lady that was the usherette there was a Maggie Berry from Money Nick. Like, that's as much as I remember with that.
Mm. And in terms of communication then, when would the Bell household have got their first phone or television or whatever?
Well, the first phone coming, it would have been in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
No, in the early 50s. And there was an awful lot of trouble getting the telephones. And the first phone in the Tunbridge area was 200, and that was Mill Quarter Post Office. 201 was Tim Post Office. 202 was Tim Hotel. 203 was the police barracks. 204, I think, I'm open to contradiction, but I'm nearly sure that 204 was Captain Ellis. 205 was, I'm not sure, but 206 was, and them days, McLean's that lived where Jack Griffin took over.
Mm-hmm. Is that in Tomb Street?
Tomb Street. 207, I forget who it was, but 208 was Higgins's Money Glass. Alec Higgins was a local councillor and a very prominent man in the area.
Mm-hmm.
His was 208. 9 and 10, I'm not sure. 212 was Deneen Creamery.
Where was that located?
Sorry?
Where was that located at? the
that's where Charleston is at the main is now.
Yes.
213, 214, I'm not sure. 215, I'm not sure. 16, 17, 18. My father's was 221. Harry Colvin was 222. 223 was, I don't know, 226 was, 225 is the parochial house in Money Glass. 226 was here, Craig Wilson's. 228 was Sam Wolfenden Sam Wolfenden, the pig dealer. 219 was Jerry McCann,
the grocer.
Aye.
Ah, okay, Tim Street.
And after that, I'm not sure. 225 and 226 was the parochial house in here, Craig Rose.
And did the phone make a big change?
Big change to my father, who was in business. So, you know, the communications used to be that I heard a man saying that used to travel through the village, and business going to Belfast, and the post office was if you go into Tomb Street and pass the road to the left, it's got down to the Ban Bank. The first building there was the post office, and there used to be posters up, Alec Bell, please call. That was a telegram from some of the people in Belfast that they were selling potatoes to, or selling whatever it was to. Please call, there was a message for him. And this man told me, you never went past him, but there was a message in the one to Alec Bell, please call.
He was a man.
That was before the telephones come in. And there was a sad event happened at that post office. There was a big, you know, the red telephone box outside the door. And there's a fella, Devlin. Do you know Rose Devlin?
I do. Her telegram.
See, my cousin, Gerald McLaren's, her brother, her youngest brother, was sent to Tim to ring the bailer man to come to the Tullahay for bail. And he stepped out of the phone box and a lorry lost its thing and killed him coming out of the phone box.
Something hit him.
Aye, a lorry from Paperstown had him lost control. Aye.
You've a very vivid memory. I don't think I could tell you the phone numbers in the district.
Well, it's just because I was in business with my father and I was in the habit of ringing most of these numbers.
Well, your maternal grandmother, I was looking at, you did an interview with another history project.
Yeah.
And she had a farm in Ballachie at a place called Mullaboy. So
that's right.
I was wondering as a child, what was the attraction of visiting your grandmother?
Well, I was very close to my uncles who were bachelors in them days, and the grandfather and grandmother, and I would have went out to them on a Friday, and coming from school and the long evenings, of course, and I would have, on a Friday evening, I would have jumped on the bicycle and went to Ballachie. I was only 7 or 8 to roll.
Mm-hmm.
In days, little traffic was the significance there. And when I got to Ballachie, I was given shilling or whatever it was to ring home from Brames' shop on Ballachie and let them know that I got to Ballachie. And then it was only a matter of, and then father come and lifted me in the car on a Sunday night.
And what was your grandfather's farm like? Did he still use horses, did he? Or?
In the early stages of me going there, yes, they were still using horses. And I remember them buying their first tractor, which was a Ford Dexter tractor out of J. Coulter's in Belfast. And that was really the first tractor I would probably have driven.
Mm-hmm.
And my uncle would have taught me how to drive it.
Well, maybe come back to the tractor in a moment the question. I was wondering, when you were growing up, what kind of breeds of cattle were prevalent on the
Friesian farms? Friesian Shorthorn was a pretty important breed at that time. Beef Shorthorn, and then there was a Derry Shorthorn.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have been popular, but it would have been nearly all Friesians was coming in as the main. No one there farm at home, it was all Friesian cows.
And did your father keep a wide range of livestock on the farm?
No, just dairy and offshot of dairies, heifers and bullocks.
And your mother's hens?
My mother's hens.
Well, in 1947...
That's the year I was born.
The year you were born. Yeah. There was only less than 2,000 farms in Northern Ireland electricity.
Yeah.
Well, by 1960, a book called Land Use in Northern Ireland by Leslie Simmons, he found that a third of farms, 23,000, had got electricity. So I was wondering.
Oh, there was a big explosion of electricity come on to everybody in about 4 or 5 years. I remember bus coming in from school, and they're left at Geddes in Randallstown, where the main electrical contractors in that day, those days, and they done all the electrical installations about our place. And I remember us coming in from school. John was very young, and I remember my mother lifting him up and saying, "John's going to switch on the light for the first time." I remember first television, 1954, my father bought a lorry of TBF Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a new innovation, and he had got an agency for televisions, and he sold my father a television. Now, I don't think it came as early as 54. I think it was maybe near 56 or 57. But it was a wee 14-inch television screen, and that was our first television.
Well, funny, Jonathan Bale writes that a lot of farms and a lot of places in general got their first television for the coronation of 53.
Aye.
But you were...
No, we hadn't ours as early as that, because I remember the school taking us to the picture house in Randallstown.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been my first time in the picture house, but it was a school thing to see the coronation. I was that young, I didn't even understand it. I didn't know what all this pomp and ceremony was about.
And how did electricity change the way that farming was approached?
Oh, it changed it dramatically. Then the milking machine was brought in, and as I told you earlier, the refrigeration of the milk and all that. That was a big factor. Hygiene, and that a lot of the refrigerators come to the house and all that.
And talking about the milking machine and so on, how have you seen the dairy industry and the Dunedin area evolve in your lifetime?
I saw it from Han Malcolm, mm-hmm. right up to the Malcolm parlour of today.
And could you tell me a little bit about Han Malcolm? Because I think the stories of it have kind of been lost.
Han Malcolm, any farm that ever had Malcolm would be on the wood. Six cows would have been a big herd. Mm-hmm. Two or three of the household went out and took a cow and milked it. It was put through a strainer into a can and wasn't fridged or cold with cold water or anything like that.
And how many cows would your father have at that time? Milking cows?
Whenever I was growing up, he built the... I remember the byre being built, and it held 18 cows. Mm-hmm. And that uncle that I described the earlier on worked those cows night and morning.
What were the main cereal crops that were grown on the Bell farm?
Corn, okay. Oats. And then there was a subsidy come in the 60s, I think it was late 50s, early 60s, to grow barley. Mm-hmm. Because there was too much barley imported into the country, and it was trying to incentive to farmers to produce the stuff at home. Mm-hmm. And we should be put that up at Boris Johnson's head. This global theory of his, I think we have to go back to food security and grow as much at home as we can.
There's a whole lot of things you could tell Boris Johnson, maybe, you know. Whenever I was doing some reading on the topic for lots of different interviews, Leslie, we talked about this earlier, that
yeah.
I actually stumbled on your father's name. So Raymond McNamee lived on Tamley Mull Farm in Moneymore.
Yeah.
He was born in 1946, and their farm was very much concerned with the potato crop.
Aye.
And he gave a little account. He said in the early days, the type of potato grown was Arran Victory, and then they moved on to Consul.
Yes.
The potatoes were then sold to an agent in the town, Harry Canning.
Well, just to contradict you, Tamley Mull is not Moneymore, it's the outskirts of Macarthur.
Apologies, sorry. but you know it better than I do. So they were sold to an agent in the town, Harry Canning.
Harry Canning bought potatoes in that matter area, yes, on behalf of my father, but my father was the buyer. He was only an agent of so much a ton, and he bought the potatoes, and he took out my father's potato bags. And they had the Bell symbol at St. Peter's Lorries to this day. That Bell symbol is still on Peter's Lorries to this day. And they were on the each potato bag.
Mm-hmm.
And my father's name, Alec Bell, wasn't on the bag. It was just the Bell logo. And he had an agent in Draperstown, a man called Dennis Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one in the county down called Peter Fitzpatrick, based in Hilltown.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at a later stage, well, that would be wouldn't be in this period. There was a young fellow, Atchison, called Rain, bought potatoes for us as well. And a man, McCoffern, from Achadui, the Vow outside, no, not Achadui, the Vow outside Ballymoney, bought for us as well. So,
and can you remember at that period how much they would have retailed for?
I couldn't remember that, no, but you wouldn't be talking about anything like something to be £8 or £10 a ton, I would have thought. Yeah.
So you were saying earlier as well that your father was an agent for selling potatoes, but you then...
No, he was a potato merchant.
Oh, he was a potato merchant, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. In the early days when he started off in business, he was an agent for a company in Belfast called QT Barry. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember... I was very young whenever my father branched out and become his own potato merchant.
But then you began to grow potatoes yourself.
And that's whenever I left school. But that's like a bit later than the period you're talking about. Yeah. I was 17, 18 years of age.
And could you tell us a little bit about the custom of growing potatoes, the different stages and from your
experience? Every farmer would have grown potatoes. Every farmer would have had a mixed crop on paddock. Mm-hmm. And they're growing a field of corn, maybe a field of 2 or 3 acres of potatoes, mm-hmm. and different things, grass, you name it, would be the mixed crop and pattern. But we were here in Northern Ireland, we're on a very high northwesterly position, and we had the healthiest conditions for growing seed potatoes. And those seed potatoes were in demand all over Europe, because of the health status of Northern Ireland. Scotland has it a bit now, but that's only two areas. Then the farmers started penetrating on cows and cattle. Labour hard to get, and you needed labour, intensive labour, for to collect potatoes in the fields and do all that. That labour wasn't available. And then machinery came in, and the machinery was too big and too modern for the type of farms we had. And really, that's how the potato business died to death. But in the year I left school, which was 1964, Northern Ireland exported 100,000 tonnes of the variety Iron Banner. Mm-hmm. 100,000 tonnes of that one variety alone. Mm-hmm. So that's.
And was that a variety that you grew at the time?
I did grow some of the time, but not on a regular basis. But it was... It was a variety that was grown intensively in County Down, around Kilkeel, Newry, Rathdryland, around that country. That was Banner country. Mm-hmm. And that's hence why my father, that man, and held town buying on his behalf. Mm-hmm.
Well, in 2015, during the South Antrim Living Memories Project,
yeah.
One of your neighbours here, Frankie Deal, was interviewed.
Oh, yeah.
Of whom we both have very fond memories.
Oh, of course.
And he talked a bit about haymaking and the stress and anxiety that was on
yes.
farmers. And yeah. His little quote is, "The worry saving hay long ago shortened people's lives. People don't understand the pressure farmers were under." So could you explain maybe some of the seasonal pressures that farmers faced in the past?
Oh, yeah, there's no... You see, hay was the only source of winter feed in those days. Silage hadn't come in, and you were dependent on the weather as today. And it was an awful stressful time. Everybody wanted to make the best hay, and you wouldn't even have the weather forecasts as updated as you have today. And people were tapping at the barometer and things like that. And it was an awful stress, because you had to maintain your winter milk supply. You had to have good fodder. Mm. And it was a gamble whether you got good stuff or bad. And the stress of it was one of those. I know a man that really took his own life
And I suppose if
and then silage come in.
And if you missed your hay, the quality of it would go down.
Absolutely. And then silage was a godsend. And then at some point say it wasn't perfect either, but the round bale come in and the plastic cover, and that just took all the pressure off. You have the option now of making hay, making silage, making haylage, or round bale silage. That pressure's gone.
You've lots of different options.
Lots of different options.
Well, back in the very, very early days, what kind of machinery was used for making hay, and who would you have had all the machinery on your farm at Dunedin, or did you have to bring in a contractor?
No, we would have our own machinery, but it was primitive of a comparison to today's machinery. I remember the first machine that we had in Grenade was a thing called a Whuttler.
Yes.
From the 60s, I just wondered about the bag of it. And then there was all around kickers of sorts, but I wasn't much experience then. But then there was a hay machine come in called a Centipede. Waterson's Macra felt at the agency probably my labor, the godsend. They couldn't bring them in, they were so successful, they couldn't bring them in quick enough. And the whole principle of hay kicking today is still that Centipede principle. It's all the same system.
And when, firstly, and why do you think a transition occurred between hay making and silage?
I think that came in the early 60s. Whatever research the Ministry of Agriculture done, I don't know if they put in a subsidy to go towards silage, but they definitely give you a subsidy to build silos. There were all roof silos in those days. And then that had a bit rolled and rolled and rolled with a tractor on top of it. It was a big move from hay, but it wasn't perfect. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, moving on now to the flax. So I was going to ask, do you have any memories of working on or observing the flax harvest?
I do, especially out at my grandfather's farm at Ballaghy. Uh-huh. And I remember one Sunday, I was there just a wee boy looking on, and flax was a crop when it was redded. If it was ready, it had to come out. Mm-hmm. And they were strict Presbyterian God-fearing people, and they thought of flipping the flax out of the hole on a Sunday was just out of the question.
Terrible.
But they had to dog on the clothes and get in the stones of the flax and throw it out. Mm-hmm. Because they had to let it another day. That was it, finished.
So, Leslie, the flax crop is something that, like a lot of different crops, although they maybe are grown less, you still see them in rural Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
But in terms of the flax crop, it's completely gone. So it's very hard to understand the different stages of harvesting it. So whenever you pulled the flax, what was the next stages?
Pulled the flax, it was spread out in a row behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And then it had to be turned. That the top side dried, and then you turned it into the over, and then the bottom side dried.
And was there a piece of machinery for the
doing? No, that was all done by hand. And then it had to be lifted and tied in a bait, and it wasn't tied with a string, it was tied with a stalk of the flax and tied around it in a knot. And then it had to be put in a cart and taken to the dam.
Mm.
And it was put in the dam. And then when they would come to this redding stage, the farmers knew when it was ready for coming out of the dam. And then it had to be spread out again. And that flax had to be spread out and dried again.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's, I mightn't be 100% accurate with that, but I have memories of those processes.
Ah, of course.
Yeah.
And how was flax stored then?
Oh, no, it wasn't stored. Once it was ready, it was taken to, in that case, it was taken to Hamilton's Flax Mill in Ballaghy.
For Scotch.
For Scotch. And that's the last Scotch mill, only Scotch mill I ever saw working, because I was there with my uncles and my grandfather.
And what occurred in the Scotch mill then?
Well, I don't know what the scotching process was, but there was McKeever's had a Scotch mill. McClure's, where Ross's has there now at Artlone, there was two Scotch mills there.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that, you remember Willie John Dobbin?
Yes.
Willie John Dobbin was a Scotcher. Do you remember another old woman called Sarah Mary McKeown?
I think I heard my grandparents talking about it.
She was a Scotcher. That's all the only work outside our own wee farm that she ever done. They were Scotchers. And Willie John Dobbin had a brawler killed in McClure's Scotch mill. I don't know what the process entailed, but I know he lost his life.
Well, the flax industry, I suppose, is famous for being dangerous, the factories and things. So were there many farms that had their own lint dam for redding the flax?
Most farmers had their own lint dam, but a farmer that wasn't in that privileged position, they would have neighbours who weren't using theirs. If I was finished for the year with my lint dam, if you were a neighbour, you'd come and use ours.
So you put the flax in and weighed it down with stones?
That's correct. That was to keep it down so it was getting the full attention of the water.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the retin, was the retin the rotting of the bark on the outside?
That
to
is
get it
correct.
The fibers?
Yes. Yeah. I think you're right now. I was too young to remember that. I think you're going the far away at that.
Now, your father grew flax for thatching buildings such as the old rectory.
Yes, which he grew because because we owned the old rectory.
Yes.
And had to be thatched periodically. And he grew flax in his own farm for the purpose of thatching his own house.
Mm-hmm.
And then the process there was it had to be dried out as well. And then the seeds had to be taken off it. And they had a wee small thrashing machine which went with a pulley of a tractor. And you put the beet into it and it took the seeds off. Of course, if you had to put the flax on the roof, the seeds would have grown on the roof. See, and so the seeds had to be taken off it. And he, whenever that house went to the Ulster Folk Museum, it went in 1972. And that went to the Folk Museum. He supplied the thatch for it.
And
just before you go any further, there was a fellow, John McCorley, down the road.
Yes.
John McCorley and me transported that house to Kiltra Museum.
What way did you take it? On a lorry?
On a flat lorry. But we didn't load the stones. The people, the special masons from the museum, come and they put the stones on the lorry and have them marked and labelled and noted where they were in the lorry, for they wanted them placed on a particular place when we arrived at the museum.
Were there many thatched houses in this
area? Oh, yes, there were. In this immediate area?
Yes.
Well, Maggie Brady's pub at Staffordstown, Jimmy Brady's, Maggie Brady's pub at Staffordstown was a famous one. Malone's pub was thatched.
I didn't know that.
John McKeever's of Money Nick was thatched. It was burnt in the Troubles. And where else was thatched? Just offhand, and then the rectory at our place was thatched, but no, there was quite a few on my day.
And could you tell us a little bit about the tradesmen who worked as thatchers?
Oh, well, on my day, the first man I remember thatching or patching up in that house was an old man, Bradley. And he lived about Leitrim out there, you know, where Patsy Keenan's place is there.
Whereabouts is that?
At Leitrim, Castle Dawson.
Ah, okay, right, right.
And he lived in a thatched house. And I remember my father going, a wee youngster sailing in the car with him, and he was going to see this old boy, Bradley. And he was a big, heavy man. And he was the first thatcher I remember. But then there was a man called John Agnew from Cloney.
Mm-hmm.
And he done most of the thatching. And then he introduced a son of his, Jerry, to the thatching. And I think Jerry has a son still thatching. And my father introduced them to the museum. And I think it was then thatched that rectory when it went to the museum the first time.
And how did the thatcher go about his work then?
Oh, it was he just had a ladder. And that was it. And they went up and they had what they called scallops, was a particular stick. And they were pointed. And that's what the thatch on the roof was pinned down with these stick-like stakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And But there's no pressure in the sense that the old rectory, lots of history has been written about it.
Yes, places. Yeah.
But in terms of your perspective, what do you know about the history of the old rectory?
I only can go by hearsay.
Yes.
And the rectory was supposed to be built away in the 1600s. But then I was told that the first job was an inn.
Mm-hmm.
Which is now the Gloverstown Road, was supposed to be one of the main thoroughfares between Belfast and Belfast and Derry main road before the A6 was built.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then it was told it was a courthouse. And there's a whooping post in it, which is there to be seen to this day. And after the whatever sentence you got at court, if it was involved a whooping, that's what this whooping post was for. And there was a big open hearth on it. You just look straight up the chimney.
And how did your father decide to allow that building to go off to the folk?
No, he didn't decide it. It must have been down in history somewhere along the line, and they approached him if he would permit them to buy the house off him. And I, at the end days, you're only talking about pounds or nothing.
Well, the next topic we'll move on to, I suppose, is the horses and the tractor. And I was going to ask you, What kind of memories do you have of horses being used to pull wagons and implements?
I don't remember horses all in my grandfather's place, and I was only in their last stages, and I remember an uncle of mine ploughing with them. Mm-hmm. And then the new progress, I think that progress, or not progress, sorry, the Fords and Dexter Technicum, I think it was 1958.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the beginning of 1939, there were just over 500 tractors in Northern Ireland, 550. Yeah. But by March 1945, this had risen to 7,300, and it continued to rise. I was wondering, could you tell us a little bit about how tractors were introduced to the Bell farm?
Well, I remember the first tractor to come out of Moors in Ramblestown was a Davy Brown TVO.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a young fella, Frankie Stewart, come to work for my father. He was reared somewhere about the name. And he come to drive this tractor from the father. And I remember him, she had to be swung with a handle. And if he didn't get it right, she could have kicked back. And this particular day, she didn't, and broke his arm.
Oh my God.
That fella eventually went to New Zealand. And he never came back again. He came back in a cremation box. And but I remember that distinctly. And I remember my sister Annette was the youngest of the nearly enough the youngest of the family at that time. And I lifted her up, he said, "I'll be back in 2 years to give you a sale on the tractor." And he never came back. And Annette and I went to New Zealand to visit an uncle of mine, and we got in touch with that fella, Frank Stewart. But he didn't say he was coming to see us, and we went away for the day. And the hotel we were staying in told us that the man and the woman were sitting all day waiting on us.
You missed them.
Missed them. But I met his wife after he died. She brought the cremation box home, and it's bringing the main church along with the other family members.
Well, there was a gentleman interviewed in 2017 for a Mahara Roots project, all about memories of farming life. And he talked about very vividly about the experiences of being a young boy driving a tractor. And he said, I remember the first time my father said, "Away you go," when I was asked, as I always had done, "Can I bring the tractor over?"
Aye.
And I can still remember the mix of emotions going on in that moment. I must have passed the test because I never looked back.
Aye.
And I was wondering, could you tell us a little bit about what it was like as a youngster to drive a tractor?
The first tractor I ever drove was the one out at Mullaghboy at my uncle's place. My particular uncle and Uncle Gerald of mine, he was very patient with me, and he taught me how to drive it.
And was the tractor an exciting thing?
Dear me, it was exciting. Aye, of course.
And what did you start off doing then?
You just maybe took it for a wee drive up the yard.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't do any practical work with it.
Well, thanks very much, Leslie. I'm just moving on. I was going to ask then about the blacksmith. We are covering hiring fairs and things, but I think that
that's long before your time.
But I was wondering how important was the work of the blacksmith on the Bell Farm, and can you tell us a little bit about your memories of the local blacksmith?
Well, the local blacksmith, of course, was Jim McKee, and later his son Jim McKee. But old Jim McKee, he was the horse blacksmith, and I can remember horses standing at the forge getting fetched. And his grandson Robert carries that tradition on to this day. And Jim McKee Jr. was more a hands-on welder and working at the forge in that capacity. But they were fantastic tradesmen. And on a summer's day with farm machinery breaking down, especially at high tide, you couldn't get up the lane. You'd be queued down the lane.
And was the blacksmiths used as a sort of meeting place for farmers, somewhere to have a bit of a yarn?
To a certain extent, but it would have been nearly all business, you know, and implements broke down and they'd been there getting them fixed.
Well, following on from your story about the New Zealand relative, Leslie, was there any emigration from farming families in Dunedin in your youth? And did any of your siblings or yourself ever consider migrating?
Well, one particular, I'm not familiar with them, but my son Peter is.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever he'd done his year in New Zealand, he was sent to this farm by the name of Glass.
Mm-hmm.
And they come from Money Glass.
There you are.
There's a lane opposite Money Glass Chapel, and it's known as Muckram. And they came from there. And the woman of the house heard that this young fellow from Northern Ireland was there, and she came out to speak to him. And Peter knew nothing about them. He didn't know anything about their history. And they're very, very big milk producers. I think they maybe milk up on 1,000 cows. And they left there and went to New Zealand. And this woman came out to me and she said, "Where are you from?" He says, "I'm from a place called Toombridge." She says, "We're from Toombridge." They had migrated. Now that was, I would think that was in the 60s, but I don't remember them. Mm-hmm. But Peter had a long interview with them.
Yeah. And was there, did you ever consider migrating yourself? Or was
not
that...
really, no, because I was designed to stay at home and, mm-hmm. and get into the business along with my father, which I have some regrets about, but overall, I say I made the right decision.
And back in your younger days, how did farmers use their livestock? I think you talked a little bit about this before, to barter for goods in the local shops and groceries.
Well, eggs was the only experience I had of that. Yeah.
And to what extent was your father able to use Toom as a marketplace?
I know, and his before my time, you described earlier there about the fairs, mm-hmm. the Lackey Fair and Toom Fair. I just remember the Lackey Fair with enough to do, but I don't even remember Toom, and I'm not talking about the modern day Toom Fair, I'm talking about there was a Toom Fair and there was a Ranaldstown Fair. Ranaldstown Fair was on a Wednesday. I'm really sure Toom Fair was on a Monday. It was where Michael's Yard is now. And that was a big, you see, you had a grass seed market. My father bought a grass seed and farmers and sold it. He was an agent for a company in Belfast called McClinton's. And he bought grass seed of farmers at the fairs on behalf of these big boys who machined it and tidied it up presentable for selling to farmers. He went round, he'd done Toom Fair, Ranaldstown Fair, Mataura Fair, Port Lanoan Fair. I think they'd done five weekdays he'd done a fair. That was only in the autumn time when the grass seed was harvested and cleaned and presented for sale.
Well, we move on now to the topic of neighbours. And in your interview so far, Leslie, it seems that neighbours were a very important part of the family.
No question, no, absolutely no question to that. There was one old man, two old men lived beside us, and they were very, very close friends with my father. One was John McKeever of Ivyburg, where Donald McKeever lives today. And the other was a man, James Chesney, who lives where my brother John lives today. Mm-hmm. And they were like gods to my father, great advisors and give him great advice. And he would have maybe helped them and they helped him. And then there was an Andrews family, which were worked closely with my father too. And that was a very important part of that era. Yeah.
Well, during the South Antrim Living Memories Project, one of the interviewees, Cattle Boy, talked about this tradition of morrowing, the idea that during the seasons of harvest, you could swap implements or men. Or
yes, whatever. That's right. Yeah.
So what experiences did the Bell Farm have with that?
I can't really remember much about that, I have to say.
Swapping stuff?
Not so much. But the Andrews family would have been one we would have done that. And the Stewart family would have done that. But outside that, I don't really remember much of it. But I know it was a tradition very much done, and particularly in County Derry. Yeah.
And whenever it came to the big days in the farm, like the threshing day or the...
Oh, that was a big day. I could have lost my life on a threshing day. I was a young boy and mad about machinery. Mm-hmm. And Barney McCauley was thrashing for my father. And Tommy Devlin was every young boy's hero. You know, and when Tommy Devlin was there, we had a bit of air. The baler was a long chamber baler. And to make a bale, you put a big thing like a fork into the baler. And then as the hay was put in, kept coming up. And then you put in another fork and that made a bale. Mm-hmm. But there was a steel bar which supported this chamber. And I was a young boy standing with my arm around this bar. And Tommy Devlin was attempting, taking the bales out of the thing. And there was a lot of, my father had a lorry in the field, and there was a lot of young neighbour girls were wrestling and carrying on in the lorry, and I was watching this until the bale came up and caught my hair. And Tommy Devlin, I would say, was a lad about 20 years of age, and he lifted his fist and he burst the bale. I remember he should have took me in.
Saved your life. Well, whenever it came to the threshing, what sort of jobs would you have done as a young man?
Oh, I wouldn't have been part of that.
Well, you weren't part of that.
No, as a matter of fact, my wife Mary had an uncle killed in a threshing machine when he was 19. Dangerous, dangerous, dangerous.
And, but I mean, whenever it came to then the flax crop, what kind of, so you needed lots of labourers to help with the lint dam and whatever, where would they have came from, or?
That morrow and the thing would have been part of that, yes. But the mostly there was what they called the bin, they called it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the bin was men that worked on pretty, pretty small farms, mainly around the Draperstown, Mullymore, Tubbermore area, and a small farm, and they were anxious for this extra pound or two. And they would have formed a bin, and maybe about 20 men, and that bin would have come and pulled my flax the day. They would have moved on to maybe Andrews's tomorrow, Stuart's the next day. That's the way that worked. And then men came to work sitting in the back of a lorry. Mm-hmm. There were no luxury coaches.
We've talked a lot about farming implements and harvesting techniques, and I was going to ask you, Leslie, how have they evolved in your lifetime? How has farm implements evolved?
Our farm has evolved dramatically. Modern day machinery, sure, the tractors now the day that up to 200 horsepower, you know?
Mm.
And the implements that would have been turning a swath of grass for hay would now take them 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
And the fields are bigger, and cattle farms now are penetrated in specific things, milking cows, suck cows, growing crops, specific. The mixed farming is gone.
Yeah.
And there's a theory that might be encouraged to come back again, but I don't think it will ever do.
Well, I suppose moving on then to, agriculture in the state, Rosemary Harris again described that there was a lot of tension between farmers of both communities whenever it came to the Ministry of Agriculture, and they found that, you know, they were interfering rather than helping the farmers. So
I couldn't agree with that.
You don't agree with that?
No, because farmers of all communities enjoyed the advice that the advisory, the Department of Agriculture advisors give, and they enhanced the modern technologies and chemical sprays, the amount of fertilizer to put on, the ground soil analysis. There was all things that weren't done at the area that we were first speaking of there, and it's only by increasing by agricultural advisors based in Ballymena, and this whole area benefited from them, all types.
Well, was your
which was the way it should be, of course.
Well, was your father a member of the Ulster Farmers Union?
Well, he was a member of the Ulster Farmers Union, and they never really were anything to me other than an insurance company.
Mm.
You know, I couldn't really say that they advised the. But every industry needs a body to represent it.
Mm-hmm.
And it does represent us in negotiations with different bodies, like Ministry of Agriculture, different bodies. And it does represent us. And they do create a certain policy for agriculture. But in my capacity, my experience with them is more business insurance and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So none of the committees or the politics?
No, nothing to do, no.
Well, what kind of relationship would the Bell Farm have had with the local vet, and who, for instance, would have been the vet for your
Well, excuse me. Mm-hmm. The first local vet we had was a man called James McIlvaney.
Mm-hmm.
Character. had too much of an appetite for alcohol, and but an exceptionally clever man. And I have to say, and it's an pretty outside friend relation of your own.
Oh, I didn't know that.
His mother was a void.
Ah, that connection is
Yeah. And that's where the brains come in too, you see. But anyway, there was a lot of stories about James McVinney, and I, he used to come to our house and do vetting for my father. My father had a soft spot for him. And most all our farmers had moved away from him because they had no means of transport. They had no source of medicine. You had to take him to Oliphant's chemist and Castle. That's where Sam Smith's chemist is now. You had to take him there to get whatever supplies he needed. Then he came back and treated the animal.
Mm-hmm.
There was a story went about James Michael Downey that the three old ladies had a draper shop in town called Miss Mulholland's. And these old ladies had a wee pet dog, and it was like a child. Their dog was dying with old age. But Mr. Michael Downey was summoned to come and see the dog. And he said to them, I'll have to come and visit it every day and give them an injection. And of course, this went on for maybe 2 or 3 months. And every morning he'd come, he'd put a jug of water on it or something. And he drew a pound straight across to Tiger's Bar and drunk the pound.
Very unethical.
But this morning he arrived to do his daily visit to the wee dog. And the first thing out of Bridget arrived at the door, she was crying. Eva stuck her head around the corner and she was inconsolable, and all around it all, she couldn't appear. She was not much sorrow over this dog. Mr. Michael Downey, you're never as sorry as we are today. Because it's just wee Trixie has passed away. I was saying, Miss Mulholland, I'm very, very sorry to hear that, but no matter how sorry you are not as sorry as me.
He wanted more money for nefarious.
And here's another story. I was driving the lorry at the time, and I was going down to Dublin, and there was an international rugby match on in Dublin. And the famous Willie John McBride was on doing one of these fillers of a commentary before the match would start, talking all sorts of stuff. And I forget who the other Irish international was on, but there was an interview anyway, and I had the wireless on, and I was listening to this. And Willie John McBride started to tell the story about his family farm, and his father died when they were very young, and his mother was a God-fearing religious woman, and there was only he had three brothers and himself and a sister, but she kept a horse, and the horse wasn't feeling well, so the local vet was called, and he says, my two brothers and me were selling this horse. And he says that the vet examined the horse up and down and up and down and put his hands around it everywhere. And he says, do you keep any wee still about the house? And her being a religious Presbyterian woman, no. But she sent my youngest brother off to a neighbour's knowing that they might have a wee taste. And he was still examining this horse, and we were holding it, McBride says, and the younger's brother come back and they had a bottle of wee still. And he reaches it to the vet. The vet put it to his head and read it, and he says, your horse will be all right tomorrow. And I knew immediately who the vet was.
No, very unethical, but I suppose a funny story.
But he was a genius, only alcohol took over his life.
And what kind of attitudes did the older generation have towards modern technology and animal husbandry? I'm thinking...
Just before you go on to that, you asked me about vets,
and
I'll give you that insight. And then our first vet after that was a man called Sean McBride,
mm-hmm.
who was an Antrim. And then he joined forces with the present-day Henry Grimmon.
Yes.
And then Henry took over this side of the practice, and we were customers of Henry Grimmon's, of being local. And then after that, James Collins and Mac Grafelt took over Henry Gribbin's practice, and they were there to this day. So different, follow on from the McLooney was so fascinating that took so long. Go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to ask, and that's great detail, you know, the different families that you've contracted there. But what kind of attitudes did the older farming generation have towards modern animal husbandry techniques brought in by vets? And did they have their own kind of cures or?
Yes, someone, my brother John would be a fine example of that. He would have been into curing animals himself. But I always depended on the advice of Henry Gribbin or James Collins. But I wouldn't have been a stock man to the extent that my brother John was. But he would have doctored animals himself, and maybe even for other people too. Yeah.
And when did you get into business with your own father then?
Remember I left school, I went into business with my father. And then in the summertime, there wasn't much trading done, so I grew potatoes.
And I mean, obviously, the original Bale Farm is over at the townland of
Listenercluskie.
Yes,
but my father was born in Aughacarnahan.
Oh, where's that at?
Where Brian Devlin's is today.
Okay.
He was not in the house Brian Devlin's, and there's a house on the other side of the road, on the other side of the yard. That is the Bale. That's where my father was born. Mm-hmm. And then they moved from there to beside Alexander's. It wasn't Drum Call. What's this the name of it? Oh, I forget the name of the townland. But up above Dunedin Church, they moved there. And then whenever his uncle died, they sold that wee bit of land and they moved down into Dunedin and down into Listenercluskie.
And when you say it was common for farmers of that period to buy multiple farms, because So how did your, if you don't mind asking, you know, how did your father manage to go from farm to farm, place to place?
Well, in those days, maybe it was a Mustang, maybe, you know.
An expansion as well, more acres. So you came to, we're now speaking in the farm we spoke of is minutes away across the road, but
yes.
Your farm belonged to Craig Wilson.
This farm we're sitting in now, yes, this is
so
Craig
when
Wilson.
Did you move to here then?
72.
Okay.
We're here 50 years this year, and Craig Wilson had no wool made. Now, this is a gallery. I don't want to discuss the people's business that I don't know enough about, but the story went that he had no wool made, and he had two daughters and a son, and they weren't agriculturally minded. There were two of them went on to be doctors, and the girl had some health capacity as well. I don't know what her occupation was, but she was in health of some description. And they sold the farm and took the spoils, and then we bought it at that time.
And whenever you came to your own farm, how did you diversify out?
Well, I didn't really come to my own farm until maybe 20, 30 years ago. John and me farmed together on the farm.
Yes. I mean, the recent history of the farm is that you've diversified out into the haulage business.
Oh, yes, yeah.
How did you get started on that then?
Well, we always had lorries. And the first lorry until he was born. Very first lorry my father bought was bought by Bobby Murray in 1948 or 49.
And that was for the potatoes?
Throwing potatoes and fertilizer and stuff. And then a man, Billy Tedford, up the road here drove it. And then there was a second lorry bought for the Aikens of Oma. Not the Aikens of Oma, sorry, Aikens of Clody, near Derry. And then that there's a photograph of a Cromer lorry that was bought in 1954.
So I'd just like to say thank you so much, Leslie, for taking the time to do this interview tonight. And your memories have been very vivid, and you've given a lot of detail. And not only are you, I suppose, filling in the gaps in history that we don't have on record, but you're also giving a perspective to young people on traditions that we're no longer familiar with. And even as a student and as someone who works, collecting oral histories with Tidal, it's great to get that first-hand perspective and learn, you know, how the flex crop was brought in or what it was like for the tractor to come for the first time, you know. So thanks so much for the interview. And are there any concluding remarks that you want to give us?
You're more than welcome.